many, many years ago up in, even before 1935, up in Manchester, Vermont, when Abby and Bill's wife, Lois, and everybody, they all met as young people. And it seems to me there was a seed planted then that would eventually become the formation. And look how widespread it was. It came out from Little Vermont, and it brought in ideas from Switzerland. Carl Jung didn't want to deal with alcoholics. He did not like alcoholics. He didn't know what to do with them. And he was a very brave man, and a very courageous man, and a very humble man, because he was the second greatest psychiatrist at the time. And if he had not honestly said to Roland Hazard, when Roland Hazard got drunk again, "I'm sorry, I have never seen a case like yours recover, ever. Never seen a case like a chronic alcoholic of your type recover, ever." And Roland feels the gates of hell clash on him. What was he going to do? No pill's going to help him. Although he did have medication at one stage, he was under heavy medication. And that's when Jung said, he said, "What I've heard about is once in a while people have huge emotional displacements. And those huge emotional displacements are the huge emotional displacement that can take an insane person like me and enable me to see the world with a little sanity by believing that something, even if it's you in the beginning, that you'll keep me sane, that you'll keep me in check." Like Clancy used to tell me, "Mary, when you're arguing with your husband, don't have a knife nearby." That's a few years ago. Quite a few years ago. I was told the things to do to keep that insanity, because some of us are more like that than others. And I was given very specific directions by the beautiful sponsors I have. And today, of course, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Because most days today I live in sanity. I'll finish with this little thing to tell you about the alcoholic mind that we love to talk about. A few years ago, my husband had, it's quite a long time ago. I was only 8 years sober. My husband had had a massive stroke. And he couldn't speak and he couldn't understand the spoken word. And he had to go into behavioral therapy before I could take him home. He was right arm paralysis. His right brain had gone completely. He could not even say his name. If you said, "Touch your nose," he couldn't. And he'd been a brilliant guy. He couldn't read. So the psychiatrist at the Behavioral Institute called me down. And they said, "Mary, your husband, we know your husband was a recovering alcoholic, and so are you." He said, "But we can't communicate with him. And we know that alcoholics don't think like normal people." He said, "They said, we have done enough studies to know that alcoholics just seem to be the usual, you know, more sensitive and can be a little emotionally immature." They said to me, "They don't seem to interpret even some facial features or gestures the way normal people do. So what we would ask you to do, because we do believe there's such a thing as an alcoholic mind." I said, "I'm 8 years sober." They said, "Yeah, but..." So they gave me these tests to do. So I did these tests, and I took the books back. They were yes, no answers. And they called me back after 3 days for the results. And when I went in to get the results, there was, I think, three psychiatrists sitting behind a long table. And they had a tape recorder at the end. And the first thing they asked me when I sat down was, "Well, who's looking after you now?" I said, "My sponsor." They said, "No, which psychiatrist are you under?" I said, "I haven't been under a psychiatrist for 8 years. They said, "Well, according to the results here, you should be." They said to me, "What medication are you on?" I said, "I don't take medication." They said, "Well, according to this..." I said, "I really admire and appreciate everything you do." I said, "But I don't think you understand the way alcoholics think. And I tried to explain to them about the 12 steps and the transformation process. But I haven't been in a mental institution for all those years, but it was hopeless. I just couldn't get through to them. And they're good men. But it just goes to show me the reason I have to do this forever is because I believe what it says in here, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And to me, that does not mean active alcoholism. To me, that means the way I think sometimes, the way I act sometimes, the fears I will still experience sometimes, and my reaction to the world sometimes. So I thank God for this. I thank God for the freedom I've had and for the life, you know, that steps one and two was the beginning of a great journey for me. Thank you.
We're going to take a break for 12 hours and 4 minutes and 15 seconds. I'm Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Join me in a moment of silence. I'm going to open with a prayer. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about this program of recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in other people, and a much needed new experience in this program of recovery. Amen.
Amen.
Just a little footnote to one of the, you know, this, the in case 99% of the people in this room know this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The spirit of the seventh tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we try to maintain our own financial integrity by paying our bills, like the room rent. No speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous is paid. If you ever hear one getting paid, you should stone them immediately. Yeah. They don't get paid.
That's right.
But to maintain our financial integrity so that that AA is not a fellowship where we only hear rich people speak, we pay for the basic travel costs and put them up. Because we to ensure that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a program that is only facilitated by the wealthy, so it gives us integrity and gives us an equal playing board across here, where everyone here has just as much of a right to participate, based in their that's enough of that. So last night we talked about lack of power as our dilemma, and the book says we had to find a power by which we could live. In my experience of suffering from alcoholism, in the periods that I would get sober and I would suffer from alcoholism till I eventually drank again, and sometimes it was such a low-level thing that I wasn't even aware that I was suffering. It's odd. I drank often at times when it would blow everybody's mind, because externally, from the outside looking at Bob, it looked like I had turned the corner and I was doing really good. And I guess I was in the material world, but I wasn't in my internal reality. I was still not quite right. And I cover it up well. Those are survival skills that most of us learn on the streets, is to look good. There's a line in Into Action. It says, more than most, the alcoholic learns to live the double life. We create these facades. And I did that, and I was very good at it. But every time I get sober, in addition to being restless, irritable, and discontent, and not even understanding it, just sort of, I ain't right. But I don't know why I'm not right. I would also have some other symptomology that I've come to attach to this thing that Bill says refers to as a spiritual illness or a spiritual malady. And it's on page 52. Some people refer to them as the bedevilments. I think this is a pretty good description of me once I get sober without a spiritual experience, without the benefit of the steps and this way of life. In the middle paragraph on 52, in the second line, it starts out saying, and see if this fits some of you, having trouble with personal relationships. You know, I wouldn't if I could get them to mind. But I had a lot of problems with, I had problems in romantic relationships, work relationships, family relationships. I was a problematic person when it came to people. So I had trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control my emotional nature. I've been diagnosed by psychiatrists, clinically depressed, also free-floating anxiety and panic disorder. And what those really mean is I think a lot, basically. I get up in here and I just get myself right here on me and I can't get myself off of me. And consequently, I angst up worrying about stuff that hasn't occurred yet, but it could, you know, and I'm that guy until I implode into a deep depression. Couldn't control my emotional nature and were a prey to misery and depression. The depression is a symptom of untreated alcoholism, which means you've quit drinking and you're abstinent, you're depressed. You're supposed to be. Matter of fact, if you quit drinking and you're not depressed, you're probably an Al-Anon, because. Because you just walked away from your best friend, the thing that allowed you to live. And so in this awkward state of abstinence, we start to apply these actions of Alcoholics Anonymous that change us from the inside out so that we can be free. Couldn't make a living. In my early sobriety, I went through 9 jobs at a rapid pace. I could get a good job because I interview well, but I couldn't hold it. It's because I'm the guy, I go to work, during the interview and the first day or two when they're showing me the ropes, they are such nice people because they're treating me special. And then after a while, they don't treat me special anymore, and I know they don't really like me, right? And I just start building a case against them, and I just start noticing how stupid they are, and I notice how they don't do it right, and I'm the guy who's always leaving, right? I can make money, but I can't make a living. I can't find a place where I can be productive and useful because of this sickness of my, in the very core of who I am. I had a feeling of a buzz in my head that wouldn't stop. It just... That's what self-centered fear does to my mind, what that blower does to those leaves. It just gets it going like this. I had a feeling of uselessness. That is something that has permeated my sense of myself as far back as I can remember. A lost, vague feeling of I don't know who I am and I don't know what I'm supposed to do in life. And I tried to be so many different things to so many people, as a lot of us do, trying to fit somewhere and be accepted, that after a while I don't even know who I am. I don't even know who I am. I'm everything I thought you wanted me to be, and I don't even know who I am. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do in life. And I remember coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to resent some of the old-timers because some of them, not all of them, some of the old-timers looked like they needed a drink, but some of them looked like they were so centered and content, in as if they knew exactly who they were and they knew exactly what life was about and they knew what their purpose was. And you know something they did? They were properly armed with information about themselves. They knew exactly who they were. they were alcoholic and everything it is to be alcoholic, and they knew exactly what their life was about. They were given a divinely crafted purpose, crafted out of their misery and suffering and failure, and the purpose was to help other people like themselves, and all of a sudden their life made sense. It made sense. And the feeling of uselessness goes away. We're full of fear. I'm a guy, I'm a worrier. It's funny, I didn't even think that worry was fear. I worry about everything. I live in my head solving problems that haven't occurred yet. In my first 5 years of sobriety, I had at least 30 just brilliant deathbed speeches because I'm imagining I'm suffering from some terminal illness. I mean, I don't get headaches. I get brain tumors. You know, I'm that guy. I just go right there. I go all the way. So I was full of fear. I worried about everything. I worried about what you think of me was a big piece of business in my mind, wondering all the time what you think of me. It drove me. It drove how I dressed. It drove how I conducted myself. It would even drive how I would sit in a meeting and share, because you got to find that right positioning. So you look cool, but not too cool. You look like you know what you're talking about, but you don't want to look too smug. So you got to get that. It's that blend of authority and humility, kind of at the same time. It's an art form. I'm telling you, it's really hard. Because I'm driven by this fear of what you think of me and how I'm going to appear to you. Which, you know, I was full of fear and I was unhappy and I couldn't be of real help to other people. Well, you can't be of help to other people when you're obsessed with yourself, right? Bob B from St. Paul says something funny. Actually, he got it from his partner, but his partner said to him, he said, "Bob, you know those shadows you see in your life? They're people." I came here so self-obsessed, I don't even think I knew anybody else was in AA except me for a while. I was the only guy that mattered here. And so I couldn't be a real help to anyone. And the book says, These are bedevilments. I think they're great symptoms of they're a description, basically, of me. Once you take alcohol, I'm an alcoholic. You take the alcohol away, I'm left with the ick. And that is why I need the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. How am I going to connect with this power? Well, we enter into a process that really, it's odd. It doesn't have a lot to do with God. A little bit. There's prayers through the process. But for the most part, it's a process of self-reduction. It's a process of becoming humble as we face the truth about ourselves in this world. And on page 55 is a description. Really, it's why believing in God isn't enough for me. You know, I think some of us, if you're like me, you're God resistant, and basically out of fear, I'm God resistant. And I'm a wannabe atheist, my mind opens up more and more and more. And then I finally, through it, my experience as a result of taking the actions as if God existed, I start to come to believe. I break through this God barrier. And now I believe. And it kind of feels like you've arrived somewhere. Like, oh, I've changed. I believe in God now. If you've arrived anywhere, you've arrived at the beginning of the path. Because faith in God is not enough for us. We all kind of know that. We all know people, maybe even ourselves, who had tremendous, had great faith in God, involved in churches and things, and drank again. It's not enough. We talk about something in Alcoholics Anonymous that's different than faith. We call it conscious contact. And there's a big difference between faith and conscious contact. If you were to leave here today and get in your car and drive home, you would drive out on the roads with a faith that there are traffic laws and there are police out there somewhere to enforce them. And maybe this faith might curtail your driving habits. Maybe you'll drive a little better as a result of that faith. That's good. You get a cop in your rearview mirror with his lights flashing, you've got conscious contact, right? And one is in reality, and it's experiential, and the other is just of the mind. The problem of it just being of the mind, and here's the problem with faith. Father Martin said it best. He said that when emotion and intellect are in conflict with each other, emotion always wins because it's persistent. So when my emotions are putting the screws to me, when I just caught my wife sleeping with my best friend in sobriety, and that happened to me, when I just had another best friend of mine rip me off for a lot of money, when all those kind of things happen, someone I really care about is dying or is killed, and my emotions are in play, I have to have something more substantial than just a belief. I have to have something that has... I have to have an experience with a conscious contact with God to know beyond a shadow of a doubt, this is not faith, this is experiential, that I have something to turn to, because I will have to turn to it. There are moments in all of our sobriety, maybe not a lot, maybe in the course of a guy like me, 36 years, maybe three times, four, maybe, where my whole life was on the line and either God is everything or he's nothing and I better have something going on here. There's no human power at that moment. Because, if you've ever been in that spot, you're messed up, man. And you call your sponsor and it's just wah, 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 wah. You can't even hear what he's saying. You've got so much of you in front of you, you can't even hear your sponsor. You can't hear in meetings. You better have something more substantial. And so on page 55, it talks about the problem that guys like me face once we quit drinking. We break through the God barrier, but it's not enough. That's why I have to go on with the rest of the steps. And this is in the section on we agnostics. And so we're coming out of a part of the book where Bill's talking a lot about the commonality of our doubt, our prejudices, our fears of God, our resistance to believing in God. And he says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down in me, I didn't get that. I couldn't get that. I remember hearing old-timers talking about listening to the still small voice of God within them. I don't have that. I remember watching people in a line in front of me talk to Chuck Chamberlain as I was waiting to thank him after a talk. And one guy says to Chuck, asks him some kind of question about where do you find God? And Chuck's laughs with this little cackle and points in the guy's chest and says, he's not lost, he's right in there. Not in me. How could something so good and so powerful be inside something I know secretly to be so bad and so weak? Doesn't make sense to me. There was a woman, Diantha, who was a very spiritual woman. I used to like listen to her because she was very provocative. She'd say interesting things. And she was a knitter. And she'd just sit in the meeting and knit and smile and knit and smile. She's so spiritual. Me and some other idiot learned that if we used the F word a lot, we could get her to knit quicker. And I think we were hell-bent on making sparks fly off her knitting needles, you know, and because we're jerks, because we're idiots. We're just self-centered idiots. And one day she's talking about how much she enjoys being alone in silence, communing with God. And the way she said it was very attractive to me. I thought, yeah, man. And I'm going to go home, and I'm in silence, I'm going to commune with God. And I got home and no TV, no stereo, just quiet, me alone with God. In about 30 seconds, I had a panic attack. Because I realized when it gets quiet out here, it gets very noisy in here. And I finally had to turn the TV on. After about 30 seconds, I couldn't do it. So what's that about? Are you just lying to me? Or maybe my worst fear is true. My worst fear is that there's something stained inside of me, something really wrong with me, and God will do that for everybody else, but he's not going to do it for me. He's not there for me. And none of that's true. He actually is there for me. The problem is I'm blocked. And that's what the book says, that this power that is deep down inside of me, as if there inside of me is a portal to the hard drive of the universe, it's blocked for me. The book says it's obscured by three things. By calamity. We all know what calamity is. It's the chatter in your head. And sometimes if you're really full of a lot of self-centered fear and full of a lot of self, it's very loud in there. I mean, if God was deep down within you and he had a megaphone, you're probably not going to hear it over the clamor in your head. In the Old Testament, in Genesis, when they are talking about the Garden of Eden and they start to talk about the serpent in the garden, if you were to look at the original Hebrew that it was written in, and you were to translate the word that they used for serpent into the English, it's not really the word for serpent. The actual Hebrew word that they used was the word that they used to describe the sound the serpent made. It's the hiss and the slither. It's always there. It's talking to you right now. It's saying, what's he doing with his hand next to his head? It's just talking to you, right? It talks to you all the time. It says things to you like, don't listen to your sponsor, they're old. You know, it says things like, you have rights, you shouldn't let your boss treat you that way. It says all that stuff to you. It's the voice of judgment and opinion. It's the voice that scares you. It's the voice that pushes you and controls you. It's the voice of the enemy. I didn't know that. See, the greatest trick the ego ever does is to convince me it doesn't exist, or to convince me that its voice is me. When I was new, I was having one of those. I used to have like nervous breakdowns about every 2 days, and I just get angst up with worry about stuff. And I'm having one of those bad days where I'm just nuts, and I'm talking to this old timer, and I got this job. I don't think they like me. I'm going to lose the job. I'm going to probably end up homeless. I'll probably end up drinking. I think I have a brain tumor. I'm going on and on and just crazy stuff. I have police stuff coming at me. On and on, and he says to me in this insanity spinning in my head, he says, you think that you are your thinking, don't you? I said, well, yeah, it's my head, my thoughts. He said, that's not you. No? He said, no. You're the idiot that's listening to that crap. And I thought, that's not me. You know, I'm not this. I'm the guy that it's working on. I'm the guy. And that's why sometimes in early sobriety, we're just tired all the time. By the time I go to a late night meeting, I've been in my head all day listening to my head. It's like driving cross country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. By 8 o'clock at night, people come up to the meeting and say, Bob, how you doing? I just go, first thing I do is sigh. I just go, well, I've been stuck up in here, with this thing working on me all day long. And that's not me. So the first thing that's blocking me, obscuring me from God is calamity. It's all that in chatter, that self. I'm so full of myself and ego. and the fear that it produces. The second thing, it's pomp. And that's a good word for ego, pomp. I think most of us at some time fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. I'm so full of myself and my opinions and my judgments, and I'm right and you're wrong. I had a psychiatrist one time nail me in a rehab, and he said to me, he said, the reason guys like you don't get any better, he says, you're so, even though you have no self-esteem, you're so ego dominant, you can't listen to anybody to hear anything new. You can only listen to see how you are already right. I was full of pomp. And see, I'm a closed system. You can't change or help me. Because if all you ever listen to is what you already know, there's nothing new coming in. If nothing new's coming in, nothing changes. And I'm full of pomp. And then the last thing it says is worship of other things. I didn't understand what that meant. I thought it meant to bow down and burn incense or something towards something. I don't think I worship anything. And yet my whole life has been about seeking things to obsess on. And I didn't know it. And I was ending, I was sober a little over a year, I guess, and I was ending my first serious sober relationship. And I don't think there's a person on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. Oh, my God. You just get it right here. You can't get it off, man. It's all you think about. And I'm in pain. I'm just in my head, just jacked up. You know, we have a funny thing in the English language. When someone's really nuts, we say, that guy's out of his mind. Well, actually, if he was out of his mind, he would be doing very well. The problem is, the truth is, he's into his mind. That's why he's nuts. And I was nuts. And I go to a meeting trying to get relief, and the problem is, I can't hear nothing in the meeting. Because the big show's on the inside. I'm in my head running scenarios about when I see her, I'll say this, and then she'll probably say that, and then I'll say this, and then I'll hit her with that, and she'll realize how wrong she was and be properly ashamed of herself and beg for me to come back. You know, I'm in my head, listen, that's doing all that. And she's a member of AA, but she's not in that particular meeting. So that means that some hideous force is attached to spring to the back of my neck to the meeting room door. Every time the door opens, I go, oh, not her. Oh, not her. Right? So even if God's trying to talk to me through you people, I got none of it. I'm so self-obsessed. And I ended up going out to coffee with an old timer that was from out of town after the meeting, and I got him alone in this booth in this restaurant. Because most of the people in AA were tired of me talking about this relationship. And so I got this new guy, this new old-timer, alone in this booth. I got him hostage. I just start telling him about this relationship for 20, 30 minutes. His eyes were glazing over listening to this. And when I was done, he said something that I'd never forgotten. It rocked my world. He said, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? When he said that, I still had a lot of prejudices about religion and stuff. And I said, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he starts laughing. He says, yeah. He says, you and I are very much alike. He says, guys like us have a hard time with the thou shalt not. He said, but in actuality, the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. And the first commandment has been tweaked into the English. It had an authoritarian spin put on them, as they all did. And it now states that I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not put false gods before me. And he said to me, when you worship something, it doesn't mean to bow down to it. It means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards something. He said, You can put anything you want between you and God still loves you. The problem is you just put something between you and God. You've blocked the light. And he said, you want to know what you worship? He says, it's very simple. At the end of the day, make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about, and the thing that would dominate the pie graph would obviously be the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards? When he said that, in my mind it was so clear. This pie graph, little sliver work, little sliver AA, and the rest of it was the relationship. And I knew why it felt like someone had stepped on the oxygen hose to my soul. Because I had put that right between me and you and me and God and me and life itself. It was just on me like that creature in the movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. And I couldn't get it off. And I did that. Now, why would I do that with a relationship? The same reason you might do it for money, or you might do it for a resentment because you want to be right, is there's an illusion of power in these things that we put right here. It's in the relationship, the illusion is that if I had the right person loving me the right way, surely then I will have found the power to validate myself and make me whole. Or as it says in the big book, we're victims of a delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if we only manage well. And we do it with, I do it with money, I do it with sex, I do it with being right, I do it with a lot of stuff. But everything I've ever done it with came with it an illusion of power. But there is no power there. And some of us know that. And yet we forget that. If you have an alcoholic mind, you will forget what you should remember and you will remember what you should forget. I mean, I used to forget that I couldn't drink, but I'd remember what the second grade teacher did to me. You know, I mean, it was like, right, the things that would make me miserable, I'd remember, and the things that I should remember not to be miserable, I'd forget. And the alcoholic mind doesn't want the alcoholic to see the picture, because then if you know that the truth will diminish its control. And so I started to realize that these are the things that are blocking me from God, and I must unblock myself. In the Oxford group used to call it soul surgery. It was almost as if you're cutting out the thing that's making you sick. We grow through reduction. We don't grow through acquisition. That's why guys like me who went and became an alcoholism drug abuse counselor failed miserably, because the ego fancies that knowledge is power. It's not. You do not grow spiritually by acquisition of knowledge. You grow by moving towards simplicity and almost childlikeness, right? And so this is the vision of how I get closer to God. And I love this line. It says, we found the great reality. That's a great word for God. It's in capital letters, the great reality deep down within us. And then it says, in the last analysis, after you've looked everywhere else for power, in the last analysis, it says it's only there that he can be found. And we're going to enter into a journey, experiential journey today, of how to access the power, of what is the process that Alcoholics Anonymous suggests, and our individual experiences with it, because it fits, it's like a loose garment. It fits everybody just a little bit different, yet it's the same garment. Mari.
Thank you, Bob. Morning, my name is Mari. I'm an alcoholic. On page 44, it said, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Now, to any normal person, that would say this is a bit of an emergency state here. This is something that I should really pay attention to and be worried to. But it's the kind of thing that you and I will look at and say, okay, I'll have to think about that for a while. You see, the normal worries and concerns of the world are not the alcoholic's worries and concerns. The normal worries and concerns of the world just diminish into nothing compared to the ones that I can concoct in a few minutes in my own head. I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I was speaking at a conference in New Jersey. And I was lying in bed about 1:45 in the morning, and the fire alarm went off. And it was going off for a long time. I was on the 6th floor. And I was lying thinking, I wonder if I should get up. And I tried to get back to sleep. That is not a normal reaction. And eventually I decided, because it went on for so long, and then there was voices about getting downstairs. And so I got up, and it was pitch black in my room, and I went to go to the washroom, and I opened the wrong cupboard door, the wrong door. And for 1 minute, I had a vision of the Body Snatchers. This is not where I went to sleep. Immediate panic about just opening a wrong door, what I thought it should be. An idea of what I thought it should be. So then I got dressed. I made sure to just wait. I thought, put on your high heels. You want to look good, you know. PJs and high heels, you know. And I got out into the 6th floor. And there's another alcoholic standing by the emergency exit on the 6th floor. And he shouts up to me, do you think we should bother going down? Same thing, you know, to be doomed to burning or go downstairs and save yourself. You know, it's... I lived with a sense not only of impending doom, but anticipatory impending doom. I had a sponsee once, and she said, what does that really mean, a sense of impending doom? I said to her, well, that's the doom that's impending. We live in this state, but we don't realize it. You know, it says that outward appearances are not in a reality. I mean, if someone looks at us sometimes, we look absolutely okay. We can look like we're normal people. But hook us up to a brain monitor, and it's a completely different story. The lack of power that I had in my life was urgent and real, and the stuff of insanity. Who's had panic attacks in here? Wow. That's wonderful. I used to think it was just me. You know, when you have a panic attack, you are totally isolated from any form of power. It's just you. You're totally enclosed in claustrophobic self. There is no other power. What is that? It means that at some level, somewhere, at an early age, I have utterly and completely cut myself off. At the top of 47, it says, at the bottom of 47, it says, besides a seeming inability to accept much on faith. When I read that, I thought, my God, I never thought I'd seen that. My family had great faith. I didn't have any. I seem to have been, from a very early age, had a seeming inability to accept the faith of my forefathers. The Roman Catholicism of Ireland, where people had died and burned for the religion. I just didn't have it. And then I read Carl Jung. And Carl Jung was a Gnostic. And do you know what G-N-O-S-T-I-C, not agnostic, but G, do you know what the old Gnostics were? Yeah, he used to wear a Gnostic ring. Okay, the Gnostics are spoken about Thomas. St. Thomas is supposed to have been a Gnostic. It was a form of religion in the very early Christianity. And it was not based on faith. It was based on knowing. It was based on knowledge of God. And just to use a little Christian concept here, if I'm, you know, I'm not offending anybody. I'm just bringing this in. you know, Doubting Thomas is the one that said he'd only believe in Jesus if he could put his hands into the holes in the palms. He had to have direct knowledge. Faith wasn't enough. And I seem to have been of that ilk. I seem to have wanted personal knowledge. I certainly got that. I got personal knowledge of what it was to have no higher power in my life. And if there is anything, and Jung has written about it, about how we've cut ourselves off from God. I had cut myself off from God. Every year, my family used to take me to Ireland. And when I go to Ireland, they'd say to my mother, "She's not right, you know." And if you're not right in Ireland, you're not right anywhere. Because Ireland is an open-air asylum. There are actually worldwide records, more incidences of schizophrenia in Ireland than any other country in the world. So I come by this honestly. But they don't think that. They think I'm still different. You know, I have an aunt. She can be sitting having a cup of tea and all of a sudden she freezes in time. And a neighbour will come in and say, "What happened to Rose?" And they'll say, "Oh, she's just away. She'll soon be back." You know? So I go to Ireland and they're saying I'm not right. So my family take me to this big cathedral. Every time we go, I go to this big cathedral in Ireland. And on the altar is a glass case with the head of a martyr saint. He'd been, 300 years ago, he'd been hung, drawn, quartered, burnt. The English couldn't think of enough things to do to this poor guy. And he's inside, and it's just a blackened, wizened head. And it's got teeth. And my family used to sit me in the front row. And can you imagine, darling? They used to sit me in the front row and say, "We want you to study St. Oliver Plunkett. Because he really loved God." I thought, if he really loved God, I want something more than that. You know? So here I am. I'm cut off into self at a very, very early age. And I will just tell you that, I'll tell you that it was, my madness from an early age was always based on a spiritual concept. Always. It was based on something that is a difference between having true faith and searching for something and not finding it within myself. It was also based on what Bob Marley called me, narcissism. You know the story of Narcissus? It's an old Greek mythology, and I won't get into it now. But he kept sitting staring at his image in a pool until he just died, looking at himself. I had an old grandfather, and he was a weekend drunk, and I just loved him. And every Sunday morning, he'd be getting over his weekend hangover, and I would say to him, I'd see him sitting with his head in his hands, and I'd say to him, "What are you thinking about?" And he'd say to me, "I'm pondering the immensities." And I was to ponder the immensities until I almost disappeared into my navel, thinking about things. And just to tell you, the first time my panic attack came, this is what I thought about. I thought all of a sudden of eternity, and that when I died, I was 11 or 12, that when I died, I would not really be dead. I would be in a conscious state, bodiless, in eternity, for the rest of eternity. So I would be in a limbo situation, fully conscious, forever. And that was the stuff of my madness. Total and complete isolation from anything other than myself. So it was all based on self. It was all based on any external power whatsoever. Trying to describe this situation to other people, as I tried many times, and I told you about it yesterday, trying to explain this to anybody I thought would listen was an alienating experience. It says in here in We Agnostics that, do I now believe or am I willing even to believe that there is a power greater than myself? I am. Because I am utterly and completely desperate. There is nothing left and nowhere else for me to go. I have been everywhere there is to go with alcohol. I have gone to the abyss. There is nothing I used to wish for more than utter and complete unconsciousness. I wanted permanent and utter unconsciousness. My suicide attempts. We can talk about the suicide attempts that happen when we continue to drink. But my actual physical suicide attempts were based on escape from self. There's a poet called, there's an American poet called Anne Sexton. And she wrote the one thing I have ever seen. Now, she is a woman who died. They say she was alcoholic. And she died at her own hand. And she wrote this poem, and I'll just quote this little bit. It's called The Poet of Ignorance. I have a body, and I cannot escape from it. I would like to fly out of my mind, but that is out of the question. It is written in the tablet of human destiny that I am stuck here in this human form. That being so, I would like to call attention to my problem. Bob defined it so well. When we are utterly and completely encased in our head, it is a terrible place to be. Because I cannot share with anyone what is going on in my head. I was given a beautiful example of that in the very early days of Alcoholics Anonymous about the great simplicity of this. It takes very complex minds. You know, the world looks at us and thinks we're idiots. We actually, most of us, have a very high IQ. Now, Al-Anon doesn't think so, but we do. The majority of alcoholics have a high IQ, which, as Bob says, means we think too much. That is why this program of action that we have is so amazing. It is a simple antidote. I remember in the very early days of my sobriety, and someone had said to me, I was in the store, and they had seen me in all shapes and states, and they said, "How are you, Mari?" And I said, "I'm really well." I said, "Last night, I felt really suicidal, but I had a couple of Mars bars, and I called my sponsor, and I felt really good." And they are looking at me like they don't understand what I'm talking. Suicide is not an everyday conversation out there in the world, and Mars bars are not the antidote. You know, and in the very early days, you realize you can't talk to normal people because they'll call the wagon, you know. Page 50. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found a new peace and happiness, and a sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. And I love this line. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Now, that is an understatement for an alcoholic. It wasn't just heavy going. It was totally an impossible way to live in the life, because I am devoid of anything external to myself, and what is in myself is utterly and completely inadequate. I had tried everything to make myself okay. I had tried everything to be okay. I had tried everything to be my old self-contained ecosystem. Human resources utterly and completely failed me. Human relationships failed me. It talks in the 12 and 12 about this inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Why? Why is that? Because in order to form a true partnership with another human being, I have to be there. I have to be participating in the relationship. I could be having sex and thinking about death. I can be having sex and I'm totally devoid. It's like I'm looking down and saying, oh, that's interesting what they're doing right now, but I'm not feeling it. I am an observer. I am that disembodied head that has nothing from here down. That is the stuff of nightmares. And I see people nodding in here, and that is why I'm so grateful to have been in AA and to have found this place. You know, before we came here, those of you who thought like me, we really could never divulge these things to other human beings. And we know that when we tried, we felt more alienated and isolated one more time. If I am not going to get the power from God, if I have a seeming inability to accept much on faith, if I am not going to get this from any religion, and I tried religions. You know, I told you I tried the Rastafarian. The other thing I tried was jumping for Jesus. The only thing is, I was full of rum. It was downtown Kingston, which is very a rough place in Jamaica. And I'm the only white person in the room. But they're looking at me with great admiration because I'm jumping higher than any of them because I'm full of rum. And I'm giving them new songs of praises. I get very inventive for a while when I'm drinking. I tried all these things. 51 is the rock of my foundation coming out of the second step. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why they should have faith. So I have had a seeming inability to accept anything on faith, and now I'm getting a powerful reason why I should have faith. Because there's people all around me that are saying the consciousness of the presence of God. And that is very attractive to me. I want that. If you are telling me that you identify with me and that what got you out of here was not, and please, I'm not making any comment, I'm not a doctor, but that what eventually got you out of this state was not medication, but a new consciousness that you will find as you go along these steps, you're not just presenting to me relief from drinking. You're presenting to me something that I have sought for all my life. I am going to find something in here that I used to seek in the bottle. I am going to find something in here that no psychiatrist or psychologist could ever, ever give me. And it's coming in these alcoholics that have been, some of them, the worst of society, but that have felt like me. So this is where my solution is coming from. When you go to page 53, it says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, We could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? So we're getting a choice here. There are no musts. And the choice is just like the one we read back here. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or live life on a special basis. That is the choice it's talking about here. You have to have true desire. And desire, you cannot create desire for the God way of life. There is no spiritual Viagra. Desire must come from deep down within, the place that they say God is within. It comes. Do you know where desire comes from? And I'm not talking about sexual desire. I am talking about the type of desire that suddenly wants to live. That is the type of desire that suddenly, from this years and years and years of destruction of self, that's what we've been trying to do, destroy self. That suddenly, and not wanting to live, I suddenly want to live. What has given me the life? What has given me the desire for the life force? Utter and complete despair and hopelessness. When you go all the way through to the end of that utter despair and complete hopelessness, when you are alone in an alien universe and the alcohol is not even working for you anymore, have you been there? When it's not, how many people came in here with alcohol still working for them? Oh, look at the sad faces. You should have seen the regret. So when you come in here and nothing's working for you anymore and you have no contact and you've isolated yourself from the world and you just want to crawl into a fetal position because you can't die, that is utter despair, and that is the aperture when you are ready and have the desire for God's grace. Not everybody has to go that far. We have people come in that have had the hint of it. Just the hint of it, and it's been enough for them to come in. When I'm no longer filled with self-pity, when I am sitting in a room of people who are telling me they have been where I used to be, when they have told me that eventually I will be able to get well and get out of self, when they are able to sit and listen and cut me off instead of listening to my prattle and tell me, stop that, we're going to show you a new way of thinking. And I look at, when I look around my life at this stage, do you remember the tsunami in Japan and the aftermath of the tsunami? It looked like it would never, ever be cleaned up. It looked like an impossible task. And that was what my life looked like. And then I read this, We Agnostics. And the last thing I'll talk about is page 57. What is this but a miracle of healing? This is a miracle of healing. Look at us. Don't we look good? Don't we have hope? This is a miracle. I don't often say this. I don't want people coming up and accusing me of heresy and whatever. Because if I'm not in fit spiritual condition, I might tell them what I think. No, I won't. But I think that we have felt, let me talk about me. A chronic alcoholic of my type, I believe that I have felt the hand of God. And I'll tell you why I know that. Why it is my personal experience that I have felt the hand of God. Because I was utterly and completely hopeless. I was beyond human aid. Beyond human aid. I was beyond human understanding. I wasn't like you. I wasn't like the rest of the world. Everything in my life was gone. I was being found wanting by the world, and there was nothing in my life. Psychiatrists couldn't fix me. No medication could fix me. And I'm despairing and hopeless. And I come in these rooms, and I look at step one and step two, and I realize I'm not drinking anymore. What is this? Is this not a miracle? I was beyond human aid. I think we forget that time after time. Our natural state today, Saturday, is not sitting in a room talking about spiritual principles. It's having a little fun. Until it's not fun anymore, until it's humiliation and degradation and despair. So here we are. Chuck Chamberlain used to call us God's kids because it is a miracle of healing. Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. Because why? Going back to the Gnostics, I have had the knowledge of what life without God is like. And I don't want that. I have had the knowledge of what a life without faith is like. And I am willing to try the other way because circumstances have made me willing. My own personal circumstances have made me willing. It's a personal experience that brings you in here, and it's a communal experience that will make me stay here. Thank you very much.
Take 11-minute, 3-second break.